G'day, thanks for downloading the show. Hamish Blake's on the show today, but quickly before we get to that, I make this podcast with a few other people. Andy Maher is my audio producer and Rachel Barrett is my EP, and I have to pay them. So you might hear an ad here. It may be somebody else selling you some stuff, might be me selling you some stuff. If you do hear it, thanks. You help me keep the lights on. If you don't hear it, you're going to hear Hamish say something incredibly cool.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
In terms of balancing a job that means you have a profile with your family, I just think people knowing who you are is a necessary side effect of having the career I've had, and not unwelcome by any stretch of the imagination. Like, I enjoy saying hi to people out and about and whatever. But you know that that's a part of a world, a game that you're playing. It's not who you are. But if that public side of things dried up, I'm quite fine with that, because that's not who I am to my kids and my wife. He's a similar guy, but that's just sort of one of the hats I wear. So you get to understand the world of having a profile and the way that that system works. And there are, of course, giant benefits to it. Like, you get to do some amazing things, and I'm overwhelmingly grateful versus any kind of cost of losing your anonymity. But you do understand it's a game. Like, that's just a game you have to learn how to play. But I treat it as a game, because I think if you believed it, if it became your identity, you would absolutely lose yourself.
That is broadcaster, author, cyclist, dad, and just legend, Hamish Blake. And this is episode 392 of Better Than Yesterday. Hello, thank you so much for being here. Welcome to Better Than Yesterday. I'm Moshe Ginsberg. Welcome to the show. This is a podcast hoping to help you make today a little bit better than yesterday. Something you hear on this show will help you make today better than yesterday. That's a guarantee. I'm here twice a week. Mondays I'm here with a guest, Fridays I'm here with you. I've been here since 2013. So many episodes to check out. And if you like something, if you don't like something, I don't mind. Let me know. Send Osher email at gmail.com. Thank you for the great feedback that you sent in about Friday's episode about harnessing the power of the fuckets. And I really appreciate the feedback on that. I'm grateful that the Friday episodes are resonating. Thank you so much. And if you do like the podcast, if it does bring you some value, please, the greatest thing you could do for me is tell a friend. That's the best thing you could do. I don't know what to tell you, folks. Hamish Blake's on the show today. There's not much more to say. It's like when Howard Stern used to come on Letterman, he'd just go, "Ladies and gentlemen, my guest tonight is Howard Stern." That's it. There would be no intro, because it's Howard fucking Stern. Similarly, like, my guest is Hamish Blake. He is the nicest human you're ever going to meet. And I've met Guy Sebastian, and you'll hear that when we have a conversation. He is not only an incredibly busy person, he is a very particular person. He's very careful about the things that he does and doesn't do. And that he was into coming on this show and insisted on coming to my house pre-lockdown. He insisted on coming to my house because I've been doing them over Zoom for the last year. But he said, no, come, I'll come over and we'll do it properly. And we sat down here in my office and we had a conversation and it was incredible. I thought I was just in awe of this guy, not only his career and what he's achieved, his talent, but also who he is as a person. And I thought that it couldn't get any bigger, but it did. And I'd no doubt feel that you'll feel the same way. He's proof positive that to be an absolutely intergalactic superstar of broadcasting in the public eye, you don't need to be an asshole. You don't need to be a prick. You don't need to shout and yell and scream and petulantly moan if you don't get your way. No, just be Hamish Blake. Be freaking good at what you do and be nice to everybody. And what do you know? That's what happens. We dig real deep into it, and I couldn't be happier that he came here. And a massive shout out and a massive thank you to the George Martin of Hamish and Andy, Sam Kavanagh, who's the basically is Hamish and Andy and Sam. He's been their producer and collaborator for a very, very long time, and Sam lined this up. So big thanks, man. Appreciate that. Let's not stuff around. I'm here in my office and you're about to come to my office and hear what it sounded like when I sat down with Hamish Blake.
Mate, thanks for coming on. I'm really grateful man. You made it. Like Audrey said, are you nervous? I said, yeah, I am. She said, why? I'm like, because I've wanted to have Hamish on the show since I started.
Oh, no, that's so lovely.
I'm really grateful that you're here. And I was thinking this morning, do you remember the first time we met?
Oof. Look, it'd be something to do with Idol. It would have to would have to be something to do with Australian Idol. I reckon maybe I met you and you might not have remembered it because I used to work. My first ever radio gig was Melbourne, Fox FM in Melbourne, the Brekkie Show. I had a job for a year that I now know is a made-up job in radio, but I thought it was a real thing, where I was a writer on the breakfast show. And that's not a position. I've never heard of it before or since. But so our very good mate, Sammy Kavanagh, who, funnily enough, in the way that the universe turns, is now the producer of all things that we make. He, back then, was the assistant producer on the Fox breakfast show, Tracy and Matt. And so I was mates with Sammy and I was at uni and I was like starting to do stand-up comedy and he was like, look, we need someone to come and write some funny stuff or, I don't know, inject a bit of behind the scenes, a bit of extra comedy into the show.
Uh-huh.
And so it was just essentially a behind the scenes gig, but that was the year of maybe Australian Idol 1, 2001?
Right. Is that 2003.
Yeah, probably. I was actually 2003. Now, maybe I'm just
And I came on The Breakfast Show.
I reckon you did.
Yeah,
you came
on. I remembered.
That's it. But I was like, oh, my God, Usher.
Oh, sorry, man. I wouldn't have remembered.
Yeah,
like,
it was Andrew G. It was James. Oh, this is, how are you guys? And, you know, it was like, was Millsy the first year of Idol?
Yeah,
it was that year. So I've got a photo of my sister who's like, you know, braces, who's now just like an elegant 32-year-old woman, you know, mother of two, but at the time, like, you know, just a quivering 13, 14-year-old with like, you know, braces and panicking meeting Millsy. Just couldn't believe she's meeting Millsy. And these photos are from my, like, Sony Cybershot digital camera.
Yes.
So these are old. This is old stuff. So that was back. I reckon that was the first time we met.
Wow.
But it would have just been glancing. It would have been glancing.
I don't recall that. No. But I do remember the breakfast shows did have writers. You're not alone there. They had
I think
one
it was a very
Brisbane.
90s thing. It was. Like in the Peter Moon days and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. It was funny because that's wild. My story goes out the window. Because the first time I remember meeting you was in New York City at
that was the first time we really hung out.
Dukes of Hazzard,
the Johnny
junket.
Knoxville junket.
Yeah.
What were you doing that for?
I just moved to America full time.
Okay, great.
I was part time. I'm still part time there. I was like doing 8 months a year there.
Okay.
And I was doing Channel V, Idol, and Take 40 Australia. So I was able to go to the film companies. I can do one interview and I can give you 110 stations and a national television station. And they
great
went,
sell.
Great.
Great sell. Yes, so Andy and I, that was a great moment in time for me and Andy because we had this real sweet spot going on where we were like, we were keen to do radio, but all we had was a Saturday morning show. And usually a Saturday morning show goes to someone that's already doing something else like quite significant. Like Rove, for example, had the previous Saturday morning show. So it was like, it's usually, I mean, without understanding, this is with all due respect to Rove and the radio show they did, it's like you take the deal because it's like a bit of extra money and like you can make a radio station pay a high price and, you know, you pre-record 2 hours, it's a piece of cake. But we were like, this was our full-time gig doing this Saturday morning radio show. So We were in the radio station like all week preparing for our Saturday morning radio show, to the point where I'm sure people were like, what are you guys doing here? But we were like, we just come and we use the internet for free. Like, we just love being in the radio station. And yeah, we were just playing like cricket in the hallway. And it kind of probably had a lot to do with us getting a better gig in radio because we just were in the building. Yeah. And cared. Like, we were like crafting bits for Saturday. It was like completely irrelevant. Like, the even if your Saturday morning radio show is rating like a 100% share, it's not really going to move the needle for the total week. Like, there's no one listening. So it's a training ground. But because we were there, we could do the stuff that like other shows just didn't have the time to do, like go to New York for one interview. Like, the breakfast show's not doing that. And the drive show's like, yeah, but we'll like, it'll cost us a whole week of shows. But we could. So that was like our perfect year. We went to Cannes. We were going to New York. Like, we were just taking junkets everywhere. Loved it.
You mentioned two things that are really important there. One was just like being in the building,
yep,
being seen by people, and also being seen by people, oh, my God, these guys are, they're not here for four more days, but they're here busy, they're working, they're also playing cricket, they're having fun.
I think it actually, yeah, I think it had an accidental effect of just communicating the truth, which was we really cared. Like, we really loved doing it. And you and I know now, like, the longer you're in this industry, like, caring is what it's all about. Like, the people that do well care. Like, they want to do well. They're hungry and they have that desire to do well. So we were right in that crux of our life. So, like, mid-20s, we were like, we really care and we want to do well at this. We don't know how to do it. Like, we don't have any experience and there's no game plan. Like, but at least we've got enthusiasm. So I think it was like just a display of enthusiasm that we were in the building. And funnily enough, like, you realize like that goes a long way. That goes a long way. It was a display of enthusiasm, I suppose, as well, coupled with the magical side serving of no expectation. So it was like, I think you see a lot of enthusiasm these days, but with people going, okay, well, I've shown you a day of enthusiasm. Can you show me my 3-year plan until with share options? But it had none of that. It was like we didn't feel entitled to anything. We just felt like stoked to be there. And yeah, I think because that was genuine and it wasn't attached to any sort of long-term plan, like, we just never had a long-term plan and we still don't. So I think what we were discovering was, let's just enjoy this while it lasts. And the other thing that I think was really important too, and I learned a lot from that year where I was a writer on The Breakfast Show, was I thought I was very important. Like, I had to get up at 4:30 and you had to do this breakfast. That's the only year I've ever done breakfast hours, like breakfast radio hours, and it's brutal. But I thought I was important, which was when I wasn't, but it was a great thing to have that be my perception, because it's like the live fire simulation of pressure, but not actual pressure. So I was like, God, I've got to think of something. Like, I was really, you know, like, you're wringing your brain out going, I've got to think of something for this morning's show. I've got to do a good job. And so I had a huge amount of perceived pressure, and it was great training to understand what that, like, working in a live show environment is like, where it doesn't matter if you've got 10 jokes or no jokes, you're going on air in 1 minute, and that's a fact. So you're going on air with nothing or 10. Who cares? Like, doesn't matter. You're still going on air. So I like learning that, which is like a kind of a pretty important part of radio, I think, of just understanding, especially for like drive radio for us, you know, you've always got one eye on the clock from kind of like midday when you're in there and you're having fun and you're relaxing. And as your career goes on, you get more and more comfortable with that. But 3:59 always brings with it that moment of going, that little voice in your head going, are you sure you got enough for today? Are you sure you got enough for today? And I think you just have to get comfortable in that zone. So that year taught me, like, I felt the pressure of the show, but now looking back on it, like, no one would have noticed if I wasn't there.
Is it still there, though? Is it still?
All the pressure's internal, right? Like, you build up this huge pressure, like, okay, I've got to perform. Like, you put in this enormous weight on yourself in the morning.
Over the course of doing my job, I have the opportunity to be exposed to other radio teams, all right, through being interviewed for the shows that I do.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, I psychoanalyze and, you know, see, you know, who's the leader, who's the whatever, who's the whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And occasionally you'll find some teams where one of them is just checked right out. Checked right out. And I always remember, and someone that I know you'll know, early in my career when I was still at B105, when it was still called B105, Craig Bruce, I'd just started doing mid-dawns, and he was this hot shot from Fox FM. He had long hair and he was like this fucking gun, right? And he knew I was doing mid-dawns and I was, you know, 6 hours starting at midnight, whatever. And he said, look, if your heart doesn't race the moment before you turn the mic on, you should get out of the chair and let someone else have a go. And
it's good advice.
It is. It is really good advice because there's twice in my career when my heart hasn't raced and I've gone, I have to go now.
Yeah,
I have to let someone else try this because I'm out. Because absolutely what happens is you get resentful of the people around you, the show suffers. Do you still get that flutter? Like even when you're rolling into Lego Masters, everyone knows how to do it, you know? I've seen you on set, you're the fucking guy, but still.
No, I do. And I had similar advice, you know, the old adage of like, look, if you're not nervous, you're not professional. And I think it's true. I think it's really, what I think you get better at doing is like harnessing that racing, that heart race. Like you learn to be comfortable with it.
Yeah.
But I like it. I use it as a good physical reminder. Like I always still try and take a moment before you step on the set or before the mics go on. Because I think the times I haven't done it, I can notice it. But just to take one breath, like one moment to center yourself. And like, you know, I have a little thing where I'm like, I visualize like revving my brain just to increase your awareness. We're like, here we go. It's kind of like you're about to play a sport, right? Like, yeah. I don't know what ball's going to get bowled. I don't know what's going to come at me, but I'm aware. Like, yeah. I'm on. I always have that kind of like mental try and just for a breath switch on that moment, which I think is at about the same time your heart's racing. Like, that's a good time to do it. But I definitely like on Lego and stuff. Man, a huge, huge amount of it on Lego, especially season one, I had massive... I find them very funny now looking back on them, just some of the single sentence thoughts that I had in that season. Because the trajectory of a TV show is you hear the idea, you're interested, the network's talking to you about it. Oh, yeah, I can see how that would happen. You sit down with the producers, like, what if we did this? What if we did that? Especially a show that hasn't existed yet. So you're in that creation phase. And there's a bunch of stuff I think you do before a show's been made to make you feel, make everyone around the table feel better in the brainstorm. Yeah, we're going to do this joke. We're going to do this. Like, and if you can write things down and they're concrete, like, they're going to happen. What you're really doing, I think, is just trying to buy yourself a bit of comfort. So you're not like, geez, we're going to gather 80 people in a building here and spend $1 million and we don't really know what we're doing. So you're like, no, we can point to things on the run sheet and we can point to like ideas and all that stuff. You know in your heart that if the show is just that, it won't have worked. Like what you're really trying to do is create the environment for the unknown to happen. And then that's the magic that's going to make the TV show. But anyway, you're in that stage of like, this will happen. Like you're writing down your set things and it's making everyone feel more comfortable. But then on the day, you really get there and then there's like this voice in my head going, wow, this is really happening. And I prepared mentally a lot for, like I tried to get my head around this because I'd never hosted a reality show before. Like, you know this, you're standing at the front. I don't know if you ever had this moment or not standing at the front of a reality show, but I definitely had a moment of going, you're the host. Like, you can't wait for someone to say something. Like, you actually have to say what's going on. And I'm not really used to doing that in my line of work. I was just like, oh my God, I've gathered everyone here. I got to tell them what this is about. And so I just was like, I just had all these moments of the EP going, and I should say that bit, shouldn't I? Because like, I'm the host. And they're like, yeah, you're the host. So you should say that bit. I'm like, all right, that's, yeah, makes sense. Like, I suppose someone has to say it. And I suppose it's me because Brickman can't say it. Contestants can't say it because they don't know it yet. Yeah, I guess it's me. I guess I'm saying it. Like, I just constantly was like, nothing on this show will get brought up. Like, no idea or topic will get brought up unless you bring it up. And I said, there's like, especially the first few episodes, this rapid learning of going, all the stuff that you know is in this show, all these ideas won't come to the surface. You won't find out how people are feeling, what they're thinking about. We will not get into the contestants' heads unless you ask the question. Like, you have to do it. So I just had a lot of weird moments where I just sort of realized I was the host. And then a little voice would be like, you don't know how to host. And then I'd be like, no, I think I've got this. And then someone would be like, well, don't just be Jeff Probst. Like, you can't just be Jeff Probst from Survivor. I was like, no, I'm not going to be him. I'll try and be someone else. But yeah, just some very fast thinking on your feet, just going, oh my God, I'm actually the host.
It's funny listening to you say that because that explains why I think the show absolutely sings and absolutely clicks along, because we are getting a reflection of your curiosity and who you are as a person comes out in the reactions of the people. And which is, but that comes through, it translates, which is what makes it.
That's good. And I think that, you know, I reckon all good TV is just genuine. Like, scripted, unscripted, it all comes from a really genuine place, like a genuine care. And I think definitely early, that first was probably there was a time in the first episode where maybe there was an air of relief because I was like, no, the thing I gambled on caring about,
yeah,
because you know, it's not like I've been to thousands of Lego conventions. I'm not an adult Lego builder. Like, I don't know this world, but I was gambling on the fact that if I'm in the room, I reckon I'll care. I reckon I'll be interested, but I don't know. But I'm taking a punt that I will be. And I think there was that moment of getting into the room, you start to meet the people, you see it all come to life. Definitely a feeling of relief going, great, I care. I do care. This is great. I'm so relieved to find that I'm really interested in this, and I find the competition fun and I find these people fun. Then I was like, oh, phew, because otherwise this was going to be a long 2 months of pretending.
Did it change the way that you've, not just Lego, but did it change the way you play with your kids?
Good question. I think a little bit yes, a little bit no. Like, I reckon Lego, the actual Lego level was probably a few years ahead of where I took the job a little bit to impress my son, because he was five at the time, or four at the time, turning five. We were into Lego. We were buying Lego. Like, I was still sort of mostly building it, but we were doing it together, and it was beginning to be a fun thing. And I was like, I think this is really gonna impress him. And then he really didn't care that much about the show. I was like, no, I'll bring him to see it. Like, every night I'd bring stuff home from set. Like, I've made him little bits and pieces. And the first season I'd try every day to build something for my wife, for Zoe. And then just like an in-joke or like a thing from our life or some random thing. You know, like, one of them was she hates the song Bat Out of Hell. So I made a bat in a cage in hell, but chained in the cage, so the bat could never get out of hell. So there was like some really weird deep, because I was like, by first few days, it's all your standard in jokes that you have with your partner, like, ah, oh, you know, like, we like bees, so I made your bee. And then by day eight, I was like, sort of run out of oil references here. It just started to get really deep. And then I'd be like, hey, Brickman, can you make me a plane? And then he'd, because, you know, we're about to go on holidays, and he'd make a plane, and then I'd take it home. So I'd be like, this is good. This is really good. I was like, damn it. Yeah, I got Brickman to make that one. But I'd try and make little things for Sunny too. I'd be like, what do you want me to make? He'd be like, make a dragon with wheels or something. I was like, okay, great. So I'd try and do that at work, and I'd try and bring it home. But even then, he was just like kind of nonplussed. And I was telling him, like, I'm working with Lego like every day. Mm. We have millions of pieces of Lego. And then, so the first time I brought him in was probably a month into shooting. And like, on the set, like, you stop for lunch, everyone sort of like hands off, the clock stops, the contestants get to go and have lunch, which I'm sure if people thought about, they would realize we don't make them build for like 12 hours with no toilet breaks at lunch, but that's what happens. So at lunch, the room is kind of mid-build and there's Lego everywhere, but it's just sort of frozen in time. And so I took Sunny on set at lunchtime and we're walking around and just did the big reveal. I'm like, what are you, here we go. This is Dad's work. Pretty fucking cool, isn't it? So, like, here we go. This is the Lego show. And Sonny's like, yeah, I know. You told me about this. Like, this is – so, like, it completely just – he was like, yeah, you've been talking about this for a month. This is what I expected. So I was like, right, that's a good lesson. I should have told him I worked at, like, the Umbrella Factory or something and then surprised him. Although he probably would have been like, oh, I wanted to see all the umbrellas.
All the umbrellas.
So it wasn't that impressive. Until this year, this season, he's into it.
Right,
like,
right.
Now he is, like, he's watching it on catch-up. He's like, I can hear it on in the other room. He'll like run in and be like, Dad, guess who won? Guess who won? I'll be like, I don't know. Who got it? He's like, Gus and David. Their tiger won. I'm like, no way. This is incredible. Like, you can see me on the screen, right? Like, you know, I've heard of this already. He's stoked about it. So in terms of Lego, in terms of the playfulness or like the creativity on the show, I actually have learned a lot. I think I have learned a lot of those lessons and applied them in other areas of life. And definitely, yeah, it's a good question, because I reckon I owe Lego a lot for, you know, I'm just a big fan of, you know, like, I don't think any level of effort is too much to create a fun memory at home. Like, I'm just a big fan of effort. The effort reward multiplier for making memories, I just think is always worth it.
Where does that come from?
I don't know. It's a really good question. It's probably one for, you know, my therapist, but I reckon maybe it's you look back, and not saying that I didn't have an exciting childhood, but I think it's that thing of going, oh, it happens so, maybe it's a reaction to realizing how fast it happens with kids, right? And just going, you got no time. Yeah. Like I sort of think the critical mistake you could make is putting it off, right? Just to go, oh, maybe we'll do a fun memory tomorrow. Do you know what I mean? I could just see how that would be such a slippery slope, and then they're not five anymore. They're not six anymore. They're not three anymore. And so I think I just have a ferocious kind of drive to just go, let's not miss any moments here. Like, let's take all our shots, even if they're dud memories or, you know, I just don't think you can have a dud memory. I think it's like, if you putting the effort in and you're open to your kids' curiosity and you can pivot and twist and turn, you'll always end up somewhere fun. And I get, that's my favorite part about being a dad. Like, you get tons out of it. But I think Lego has given us a lot of that too, because that's the spirit of Lego, right? So it definitely helps being surrounded by that all day. Like,
yeah,
standing in a building where the whole ethos that everyone believes and lives is anything's possible. Yeah. You can make anything happen. Even if you go home and that means you're making characters out of the fruit in the fruit bowl, I think it still comes from being surrounded by that creativity all day.
And that play has value. Play is just not a thing.
Yes.
You know, I remember as a kid, it's like, it's not playtime, boys. Like, I remember that. It's like, but play is really important. It's really important to work out your brain in different ways and allow your subconscious to feed and work out and figure things out. Because it's when you're doing that stuff, the ideas for the other things show up.
I agree.
It's in the middle of all that.
I agree completely. and it's sort of like, and you have, I'm a big fan of just like freestyle playing, right? Like, in the same way that for people who are interested in fitness, like, sure, go to the gym or whatever, but just walking around and being active, just going from being at the beach and swimming and playing with your friends, like, that's also important.
Yeah.
Rather than just like, okay, I do F45.
Yeah.
Like, it can exist in that moment. Like, you can do the big stuff with your kids. You can be like, right, we're going to the movies or we're going to Luna Park. But it's the play that's the real life. Like, it's the playfulness that's real life. So, yeah. That and Bluey is probably the other huge impact.
Yeah,
like every
man.
Other parent. Like,
I still can't get over
it. Because that's what the show's about. That's what Bluey's about.
It's, yeah. And it's Dave from Custard. I just can't get past.
Do you know, I met him the other day, right?
Shut up.
You got to get him on. Get him on.
I remember him from playing in bands in Brisbane back in the olden days.
So at the Opera House, like, so I've been lucky enough to be a guest dog on Bluey, and I'm in the next season. All right. So I think from that, like, loose association, they were like, hey, they've got the live show on at the moment.
Yeah. And with the puppeteers on stage, which I love.
It's really good. Yeah. It's really
having you cue, but without the swearing.
Yeah, yeah. It's really beautifully done too, because it allows. I thought it was going to be people in mascot outfits, and who were there actually at this like event we went to. I took my little girl, and we went to, like, there's like a little before morning tea, and the Bingo and Bluey were there in the mascot outfits, and then they had to go, and I was like, all right, do they have to go and get ready for the show? And they're like, no, they're not. We're not using those ones. We use, like, puppets. It's like, okay, way better, because there's not only so much you can do with a giant mascot outfit. Yeah, so the show itself is really beautiful, and it's written by Joe Brumman. Like, it makes you cry a little bit in it, just like every Bluey episode. So it's a really well-done show. But so the cast was there beforehand, and Dave McCormick, like the voice of Bandit, came and said, oh, g'day, Hamish, how are you going? I was like, oh, Dave. That's the most starstruck I've been for a long time, just hearing Bandits say my voice, because it is him, right? Yeah. Like, it's just, he's not really putting on a voice, it's just
I do love it as a show, because it really is that just kind of play and make-believe, that beautiful sweet spot where they know it's fake, you know it's fake, but it's still.
But I go so deep on the writing tour, I just love the writing of Bluey so much, because there's always a moment in an episode where it's like, you know, mum and dad are playing, like Ben and Julia, they're playing the game, and you realize, let's say sort of two-thirds of the way in, that they knew, that, you know, they're acting like they're surprised. They're sort of pretending to be facing the same challenges as the kids. But then you get a little hint as to how much effort they've put in behind the scenes to set it up.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
And I talk about this on my show that I do with James quite a bit. I think I've got a real chip on my shoulder about how underrepresented Brisbane was in our popular culture. So I grew up there and I never saw Brisbane on my television.
And now it's just jacarandas and those big Queenslander homes.
And he is, Bluey's Kitchen is every house party I ever had.
That's,
you know,
great.
They're just missing the Gatorade sacks, you know, but it's, that's the houses in Red Hill and Paddington and stuff where we used to have house parties.
I think I saw, did you see that article like a few, there was something a few months ago going, I don't know what Bluey's dad does, but like that house nowadays is worth like $4.5 million.
Oh my God, dude. They were just like, shitbox cottages.
Yeah, yeah.
They absolutely were. But now you're 10 minutes from the city, five sets of lights from the CBD.
Yeah.
And they
primo.
Brisbane is amazing. My mates just moved there because they're like, we can't afford it in Sydney. And if two people doing well.
Yeah, yeah. It's unbelievable. And if you could live in Bandit and Chili's house.
Yeah.
It's great. And I mean, just every episode is about play. I mean, did you know he's an archaeologist?
Sick.
I didn't know.
I didn't know that was his job.
Because I feel like for two seasons, we haven't seen him do much work. Early on, he says he's got to do a bit of work from home. There's the episode where he's got the yoga ball, the bouncy ball, the big like yoga sphere. And then it turns into like an Indiana Jones like game that he's playing with the kids with the ball rolling down the hill. Because the whole time he's trying to do his work. I just feel like we haven't seen... Just haven't seen him do much work.
He's out in Western Queensland unearthing dinosaurs. That's what he's doing.
Exactly. He's up in like Winton. So I reckon, yeah, either that or we just find out that he bought some digital dollar bucks and did pretty well from the crypto dollar buck boom. He hasn't really had to do much.
Well, there's some people that have done that, and good on them. I mean,
he's probably into Dogecoin. I mean, that's their world.
Probably he got out high and he's
rode it to the moon.
Rode it to the moon. There was a moment which I loved. There was a moment when you went through a moment on air about how heavy you were.
Oh yeah. Great.
And you were going, hang on, I'm a grown man. But I'm not allowed to get on a trampoline because the trampoline is weight limited at 100 kgs and I'm coming in over a ton. Now,
I was $1.06.
You're 6'4 at least.
Yeah. Tall.
So it's coming in over a ton's fine for someone your size.
True. I mean, and I hope these days no one refers to the BMI, whatever that was, body mass. I think it's a bit of a, it's a shonk, right?
It doesn't feel right to me.
It doesn't feel right. No. But I mean, yeah, I was like, oh, wow, I never really weighed myself. But then, do you know, the moment I realized I'd perhaps... This is before I had any concept of personal nutrition or, well, long, long ago, right? This was the beginning of my journey of, you know, and it was still some months before I would learn what a calorie was. But it was like, we lived in New York. We lived up at the pizza shop. Like when we're doing gap year in America, you'd walk in, you know, you get a slice of pizza on the way into the building and a slice of pizza on the way out. It was basically like a swipe card system. Like I just wouldn't leave the house without, so... You're adding like half a pizza a day onto everything else you're eating and stuff. Like, I know this was starting to balloon, but I actually went to New Zealand. Me and Andy and a couple of our mates went to Queenstown for like 3 or 4 days. And it's like customary, I suppose, in Queenstown that you got to go bungee jumping. And there's a bungee, for people that have been to Queenstown, like in the center of the town, there's like a little gondola that goes up Queenstown Hill and you can jump off like a 50 meter ledge. You're looking out at the whole town, at the mountains, but you kind of are jumping down onto rocks. It's not like the traditional bridge one, but it's quick to do. Like it's very fast to kind of like sign up and do it. And there's a little hut there where you sign up. And we were all signing up. There's four of us. And they write on the back of your hand like when you're jumping. And so I was like, hang on a sec. How come Hato's jumping 78? Like Andy's jumping 85. I was like, I got to wait till 107. I've got to wait. I'm not waiting 20 spots to jump. And then the guy goes, no, that's your weight. You're standing on a weight plate when you sign in. So as you're signing the waiver, they have a readout of how heavy you are so they can adjust the rope. And I was like, I'm 107? The guy's like, well, you got your shoes on and your wallet and stuff. It's like, yeah.
That's what it
is. Pay not 15 kilos of gear on me though. So I was like.
Because you and Andy are about the same height, aren't
you? Yeah. So I was like, and Andy, how much is Andy? It's like, you know, 90 or something. He's like, all right. We've got a discrepancy here. So that was the sort of when I was like, okay, I've just realized I'm over 100 kilos.
Right.
And it was then we also realized like on trampolines, I have a sticker going, maximum limit of a man is 100 kilos. So that's when I became, on air, I began the campaign to become tramp legal.
Tramp legal, that's right.
And that was really where I was like, and I know you've been through a similar journey yourself. You realize, you know, it's like it's an internal thing, it's an external thing. And you realize, okay, if I'm actually going to become healthier, everyone gets there in their own way, right? But don't you think it's like, eventually the penny drops. Like it's just about awareness. Like it's about paying attention. It's about going, there's a lot of ways you can dance around it. But at the end of the day, you have to care. You just have to pay attention to what you're eating. You might get seduced by just doing heaps of exercise and so you can still eat whatever you want, but it will last for only so long. It comes down to whether it's intermittent fasting, like light and easy, whatever it is, it's about calories in, calories out. Like there just is no... If you're doing extra exercise, that's some more calories out. But that is what the science is. Like, there's just no other way. That's how the body works.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's where I began to get my head around going, no, but isn't there like supplements I could take, like a pill? Like, can you just like, I remember just learning for the first time. I got an app where you had to like enter in everything you're eating. Yeah. And you were just like, are you kidding me? It's like, a small fries is 400 calories and an egg is 90, like just, and lettuce is nothing.
Yeah.
Just getting my head around what, you know, food was.
Well, there's different kinds of calories though. Like, you know.
There's different kinds of calories.
Egg calories are different to fry calories.
They really are. And that's probably your next step. Yeah. I reckon your first step is going, let's just get under the number.
Yeah.
Then the next step is let's put better calories in your body than just lollies. Because of course, you could just have, you want to stand at 2,000 calories or whatever it is, you could just have, I guess, like 11 cans of Coke, but you can't have anything else for the day.
Oh my God.
And you'll die. I just saw Osha really shiver. But for the first time in my life, because I wasn't really a sporty, I never was that like athletic growing up.
Yeah.
And I don't blame my school. I think they offered me a tempting choice. At the school I went to, we weren't a really sporty school. You could either do, we didn't have Saturday's morning sport. We had Wednesday afternoon. And so you could play sport or go home at lunch.
See ya.
See ya, guys.
I'm out of here.
I'm out of here. And so in year 11, you had to stay at school and do something called sport ed, or aka dud sport. So it was like, you're not good enough for a team, or you're not interested in being on a team. And that year for sport ed was circus tricks. So I just learned how to juggle.
Oh, sick.
I'm a great juggler. So I learned how to like juggle and do devil sticks and stuff. Like basically I learned busking.
Yeah, rad. Straight to Edinburgh.
I learned how to busk. Like if slacklining had been invented, I would have been slacklining. Why don't you guys learn something that gives nothing to society. Like, just absolutely adds nothing.
Mate, that's how Eddie's ad started. Come on.
So, learnt that. And then the next year, you could go home.
All right.
So we've tried our hardest with
you.
Out
of here.
Just get off the property.
So, the way I talk to people about it, I've done a couple of big bicycle rides, and Amy's Grand Fondo is one, which is I've done a few times. And I say to them, it's like, so that's 5 hours of riding, mm-hmm. 120 Ks. I think it's about 2,500 meters. Elevation.
Yep.
All right. And it's hard. It's really hard.
Yep.
And that was, I showed them the Strava. I said, and that's 3,000 calories. I'm like, that's less than a kind of a drive-through supersized meal that you might get.
Yeah, you could
from,
eat 3,000 calories in a meal.
In 10 minutes, you can eat that. And
it's
they go,
brutal.
Oh, I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
Like you can, and what is my friend Ruben? He wrote a book about it. Ruben Meerman is his name. Book's called Big Fat Myths. He always says it's very easy to out-eat your exercise, but it's very hard to out-exercise your eating.
Can't out-train a bad diet.
You cannot.
Unless you're Michael Phelps. Like, literally unless you are, because, like, you know how, like, at the Olympics, it was like, this is what he eats in a day, because he's doing 10,000 calories a day.
Yeah.
Because that guy's in the pool for, like, 12 hours, and he's redlining. But that's just a wild, again, you're like at the total edge of human performance. Yeah. Not a day-to-day recommendation.
No, I do not. No.
But that's the thing. It's like, in a funny way, like, because I was like, all right, I got interested. I was like, actually prefer to be, for the first time, you know, psychologically, I'd be interested to know if this was your feeling too. Because, like, I know you were a heavier teen. Like,
yeah, 20s. I was 112 when I was 17. Yeah.
I think what happens through your teenage years is actually a really interesting psychological thing, because I didn't have any belief that this could – I just wasn't one of those guys, right? You have that internal voice going, oh, I can't be a fit guy, because you didn't learn it when you were 15. It's on us too. Like, I mean, you know, we opted out, right? Like to some extent. Like, I mean, it wasn't like people were trying.
I chose to play guitars instead.
We did other stuff, right? But then you face this thing where later in life you're beginning to get interested in maybe doing stuff like big bike rides. But I was interested to find I had the voice inside me going, but that's not for you, you can't do that. And that's the thing you had to kind of overcome. Everyone cracks that nut in their own way, but to learn, you can be that person. I just had that barrier inside me. So I've really enjoyed going through that process and becoming a bit more aware about my body, and then seeing what you could do. Like I did discover inside me around about 30 that I have a bit of a taste for hard endurance events, like or things that seem hard to me. And I think part of the attraction, and this you do find it a lot in like men and women that like end up in like that ultra endurance world, you know, like your David Goggins is your classic. You know, he was a massively overweight dude. Now he's like, you know, the baddest dude on earth. I think when you're suffering, like when you're at the right, that limit of you're hurting, you develop a fascination of going, yeah, but I'm proving to that voice that I can do this, as well as just the satisfaction of doing it. It's got an extra layer of gratification, I think, for people that have maybe had at some time in their life a belief that they couldn't do it. There's an extra layer of, I reckon, right in that dark, dark hurt locker, right at the edge where everything's screaming for you to give up. That just gives you an extra nudge to keep going, to go, but I can't believe I'm here. And I, what if I went a little bit further?
And that's the thing that makes you sign up for the next one. But it's also the thing I've found that really helps me away from the bike.
Totally.
Because when I'm at work or when I'm somewhere, I'm like, okay, so I might feel like I'm it. I might feel I'm maxed out. But I know from looking at the data.
I've felt like that before.
I'm at 40%.
Yep.
I've got so much more beyond this. And let's just keep going.
Yeah. I think it's a really interesting, you know, I guess that's why we do endurance sports and stuff, because it's like you can simulate it. Because
you also don't have to be fast. I think the other thing I like about endurance sport is
you just have to hang in there the longest.
That's exactly right. Endurance sports isn't who finishes the quickest, it's who slows down the least. And if you can get over the line, you'll get a medal. If you get over the line,
that's it.
I'm in.
It's totally a different mindset too, because it's like you're not really stuck on a mountain in a blizzard against the unknown. And so it's like you're not really up against it and fearing for your life, but you are in as much pain as you can simulate in a safe environment, right? Long runs, long rides, tough climbs, going flat out on the roll or whatever it is. Like you're at maximum sort of like simulated pain.
Yeah.
And that's where it becomes interesting, I think, to go. I think it's really helpful. I find it really helpful, like you said, away from the, like let's say on a rowing machine, which is something I'm also a bit of a fan of. You have to get to that point where you're like, I completely believe I'm done. I'm not just saying it to be cool and go a bit more. I want to ferociously want to stop. And to me, it's about trying to catch that thought and beat it, right? Sometimes it's a bar of soap and you can't catch it and you are stopped. But the times where you can catch it and go harder, they're the bits where I think you have to take a step and you're like, I completely believed I was done and I wasn't.
What do you say to yourself? Because I used to think to myself back when I could still run, I don't run anymore, but I used to say to myself, this is just a thought or this is just an idea and I can change my mind about ideas.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's pain. This idea is I'm going to stop and walk, but I can change my mind. I can go, the way I would do it is I would break it down. It's like, what's as far as I can see? That corner over there, I can run to there.
Totally.
Like, what do you do when you're in that space?
I was thinking about this. I've thought about this a lot, but I'm like, I reckon I've got a collection of the people that have helped me along the way, like different voices come into my head at different stages. Sometimes it's something I've read, or I think everyone incrementalizes it too. I reckon that would be a common thing, that you've got your own version. Like I'm like, you know, 10 good breaths. Like just, I think I try and bring it right back to the present to just go. Because we all know if you're doing a marathon or something, if you think about the finish line and you're 5Ks in, you'll stop. But if you think about the next light post, you'll get there, right? So the battle becomes like 10,000 light posts instead of one big race. So I personally, like when I'm really hurting, let's say like max effort, I'll try and bring it back to the current breath and maybe do 10 good breaths. Because I'm like, all right, what is this pain? Like, it's just pain, right? Like it's just, you can be in pain. And I think I had a great, you know, had some good advice along the way, which is I think preparing for it before you do something hard is also really helpful too, to go, you're about to be in pain. So when you get in pain, that's great. That's just the pain you expected. So it removes the shock of the pain, I suppose. So yeah, you know you're going to be in pain. And then when that voice inside you goes, this hurts, we should stop, go, no, this hurts, which we expected. And let's keep going.
Yeah.
So that's probably where my mind goes to, I think, in those harder efforts. Yeah. Bring it back to one breath and try and do one breath.
Do you break it down into like form or things like that? Do you have little triggers around?
But I think I also have a bit of a like, you do not want to, you know, in 1 minute you'll be fine. And you do not want to be sitting there going, I quit, I gave up, you know, because you're facing your demons, right? You don't want to go, I faced my demons and I flinched. So that's a little bit of like, you don't want to get off the bike here and go, God damn it, I let it go. Yeah. And then I also think it's important to like bring a bit of happiness back into it, because it shouldn't all be like, it shouldn't be this like completely soul destroying. Like what are you doing down there in the garage on your rowing machine if you're just torturing yourself? I think you've got to bring a little bit of the joy back into it too, to be like, I can, you know, you can beat this and there's like an elation in that too. Yeah. So you're like, I know I can, you know you can beat it. You know you can do it. You bring a bit of the self-belief back into it, because I think it's also, you know, for me anyway, I like exercising because I like doing it. I'm not doing it because I'm like, oh, you know, I think you have to do it from a space of like love rather than going, well, I'll hate myself if I don't do it. Because that's not a fun way to live. I'm like, I know I'll be so super happy if I can do this fun hour, because I enjoy it now. Like, I really, it's a part of my day. I try and do something every day and I love it. I really enjoy it. But I think if you were like really hurting and being like, if your self-talk was negative, like if you're like, come on, you piece of shit, do this. I don't know if you'd be in there for the right reasons.
You could have had that when you found, and as often happens, as I'm not making this up, you know, when people find themselves in that space, they're like, fuck it. And they just go and get another box of Krispy Kremes, or they feel too ashamed to even start. What would you say to someone about if they find themselves in that place, like that they feel a bit of shame about the fact they've let themselves get to this situation? And I was at a motorbike ride yesterday, and there was other dads around, and dads have baby weight.
Yeah, of course.
Totally. Oh my God. You know, in those first 2 years, you're flat stick. And
you don't sleep.
You don't have time. The days of, see ya, honey, I'm off to do West Head. I'll be back in 5 hours.
Yeah,
they're
exactly.
Gone. I can't do that anymore.
Nah.
But, you know, it's tricky. And so what would you say to, you know, guys or girls who found themselves and feel a little like, I used to be the fit kid at school, and now look at me. I'm buying new jeans.
I think it's, I mean, I definitely had that. Had that fluctuation too. I think this just comes from an honesty, just to be like, all right, I'm not anymore. But it probably just comes with, like, if you want to get back there, I suppose everyone's got their own reasons. Like, but if you feel like, I'd like to get back to that spot for me because I want to keep enjoying life. Like, for me, I'm like, I like being active. I like being able to do stuff with the kids. I like having a level of fitness that allows me to go on fun adventures, like bike rides and things with friends. Like, that's my goal. And if that, I think it comes down to people kind of honestly going, all right, this is what I want to do. I know I'm not at the spot at the moment. And that's totally okay. I think you've got to start with honesty and go, okay, well, I'm not there. And that's fine, because this happens to people. But you know you can be. I think, you know, I don't know who said it, but there's a famous saying where it's like, life is pretty simple in the sense of, like, you figure out what you want and then you pay the price. And then if I'm 45 and I want a six pack, all right, well, you could dance around a bit, but you know what the price is. The price is just going to be a lot of hard work. You probably have to just pay 100 barrels of sweat. But if you want to pay the price, that's the price. Or if you're like, you know, I feel sore and like lethargic, but I'd like to be able to, you know, race my kids up a mountain. You know, you pay the price. The price is going to take a couple of months of like going halfway up the hill and feeling like you're having a heart attack. But over time, you will get better.
But you've got, I think at the core, you're there, you're talking about the why.
Yeah. I think it's important to nail down the why at the start.
Yeah.
But just to go, I know this will take a lot of tiny steps. Yeah. Like I've had this fun, like after going through my own, you know, experiments and I find my own interest in being a bit more active in life, I've definitely have mates that have gone like, I'd like to, you know, I'd like to get fitter. I'd like to do this. And I've had fun as a side hustle, like, you know, going with mates, all right, let's do this. Let's do it together. And I reckon, yeah, an important part is finding the why and then breaking it down into just loads and loads and loads of achievable goals. And I think a key part too is like, you know, I've always had a thing of just like, you just can't look for results within the first 2 months, because I think it's that thing of like looking, if you're like, okay, I want to run a marathon, and then you get so excited about the, like, I guess the vibe around running a marathon, that when you go out for your first run, you can't run a kilometer, which I'm probably the same as you. I've got terrible knees. I would struggle to run a kilometer. Then you get disheartened and you're like, fuck it, I'm not doing it. But if you were like, well, I know for the first month, all I need to run is 500 meters and then stop and then 500 meters. I think if you can be realistic with that, that's how you incrementally build up to big things.
It's not rocket surgery.
It's not rocket surgery.
No, it really isn't.
So but that's the thing. I think we know that the temptation is to want the big glorious moment first.
Yeah.
And I think I can't remember who said this either, but I think there's a lot to be said with not vocalizing a goal or not vocalizing a big achievement. I'm definitely going to get this wrong, but I'll give the rough stats because I think it's an interesting lesson where it's like, let's say you're like, I'm going to do City to Surf, right? Let's say you're not known for being fit, you can't run a kilometer. You're like, guess what, guys? I'm going to do City Surf.
Yeah, it's a foot race in Sydney.
So that it's goes, a foot race, 15Ks.
14Ks. It's the largest time foot race in the world. 100,000 people start it. It's bananas. Awesome.
It's great. Yeah. And it's a real achievement to do it.
It's hard, too.
It's very hard.
Because people run hard. People run hard. And there's
some,
fast.
There's some big hills and, you know. But I did it many, many years ago and it was a super fun day. But let's say it's like, you know, hey, I'm the unfit guy in the office and you announce to everyone, I'm doing City Surf. I'm just like, oh, you know, Steve, well done, mate. Like, you're a legend. Unfortunately, if you were doing it for the glory of achieving the event, this thing that I read about sort of goal setting and this study was like, you actually get 80% of your gratification from announcing the mission. And then so much of the glory's gone because everyone's patting you on the back, everyone's saying that's awesome. You know, you've grabbed everyone's attention and you've got the headline, but you haven't done any of the work yet. But now there's only 20% left to do it. Like, so now you're in this huge deficit of you've kind of lost all the feel good and you haven't earned any of it. And that's why it's sort of, you know, sometimes people peter out because they're like, oh, I'm just not feeling it anymore. Like, I'm not feeling the buzz because you kind of took all the glory up front or you took a large chunk of it and it removed any of that sense of achievement for actually incrementally building up to achieving that thing. So I do think about that sometimes, like, you know, nothing to do with fitness, but I'm like, yeah, if you've got an idea for a book or something, saying to you, like, if me going is like, I'm going to write this book and this is what it's about and like, what a cool idea. And she's like, yeah, great idea. And I'm like, huh, well, I sort of got the buzz already for saying I already told you the idea and you loved it. So maybe I'll start it later. But if you were like quietly to yourself, okay, I've got this great idea. I think it's good. I'm going to work on it quietly and then I'm going to present it to the world.
Yeah.
That's probably, that's a harder discipline, but I think there's probably more chance of you achieving something, that second model.
What's the current bicycle count at the Hamish Blake House?
Current bike count. Actually, I got rid of one the other day, which is good. I got rid of the bike. I just sort of had like a real run-of-the-mill mountain bike with the baby seat on the back, like the kid seat. And my daughter's probably a little bit old for now, but I've got a mate that's got a one-year-old that he's coming right into the slot. So I was like, mate, please get this out of the garage because I think I'm going to get a mountain bike, like a good downhill mountain bike. So currently, what am I at? Probably only three bikes.
Okay.
Or maybe four bikes. But I went mountain biking in Tasmania the other week and I think I'm a bit hooked. It's really fun.
I'm sure it is. I just, the amount of mates that I've had that have gotten into a lot of trouble doing it. And I descend
plates in their head
ridiculously when given the opportunity. But my argument is that if I come off descending on a road bike, the ambulance can drive up next to me.
That's true.
Come off
that is
on a mountain
convenient.
Bike,
you
I'm a fucking winch on a helicopter. Yeah.
You're
on
a
the
St.
News.
Bernard away.
Yes, exactly.
That is true. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, road biking, you are by definition driving on an ambulance access strip.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's
true.
Yeah,
I've made you had to like carry each other out and they're like
broken legs.
K and a half from the trailhead and not small men.
Yeah, gotcha.
Up a hill to where the truck is. Like, I don't know if I want that.
I and that's probably what's kept me out of it for so long. But also road biking, like I'm just a bit over cars. Like, you know, just especially coming like recently moving to Sydney.
Oh, forget it.
It's just brutal, right?
Yeah, like it's
what an interesting sport to choose. I just like had moments where I went on the riding along in Sydney going, what an interesting sport to choose where you're just this flimsy sack of organs like zooming around at 40Ks an hour. Around cars.
Just avoiding death.
Who hate you. If I'm out here just to push myself physically, there's a part of me going, do you think you could find another way to do that? Like there's no cars at the gym. Like no one's like, it's honestly like going to a gym and every now and again, the receptionist without looking, like typing, like let's say the receptionist at the gym is just working away, like running through whoever the dude on the front desk is, he's just running through applications, he's working away, and then occasionally pulls out a revolver and fires a round into the gym. Now, it probably won't hit anyone, but that's sort of like what it is like being a cyclist. Like every now and again, you're like, fuck, that could have killed someone. But then it's over and you just get back to exercising. That's kind of like what being a cyclist is. So I'm like, do you really need to be out here risking this? And look, I do love it. So I'm like, my general rule is like I've got a bike at home, like a stationary trainer. So I'm like, I'm happy to like get my exercise points there, like get stronger at home. And then I love riding outside for a reason, like a big ride or like, you know, you're out in the mountains or you're seeing something that's not just traffic.
Yeah.
If it's just traffic, I'm not really that interested.
I'm with you.
And I think that's what I got really into mountain biking for, like down in Tassie and stuff. Like we went to this place called Derby and they've like redone this old town that was an old mining town. And then they've gone and built 200 kilometers of trails through the mountains there.
Wow.
And it's like world class.
Amazing.
And, you know, 10 years ago, you could buy a house in the town for $10,000 because it's like, it's on the way to nowhere. It's an hour and a half out of Launceston. And now it's like, by Tassie standards, super expensive. By the rest of us, not like $400,000 for a house now. But the whole town is just mountain bike centric. And everyone is pumped. Like
that's great.
The mood in the town is like euphoric. Everyone's that's just so stoked cool. to be out riding bikes and that's to be cool. you just realize like everyone here is just here to be in the forest yeah. riding bikes.
Amazing.
And it's beautiful. And I actually
all right, you've convinced me. I might have to give it a go.
And that's when you're riding, you're like, oh, this is like the whole point of these trails is just to like be in nature.
Yeah.
That's all you're doing all day long is just zooming around in nature.
Yeah, yeah. I'm with you in many ways. A new bicycle came into the house, but it's a bicycle with no wheels. Okay. I got the kicker bike, the Wahoo kicker bike, and I just ride Zwift.
Epic.
That's what I do.
Yeah.
That's what I do. Because
you're probably a little bit like me. Like, I mean, I know this is getting really nerdy, but when you've got a watt bike or a kicker or something that measures watts, you just get obsessed with your numbers, and it's just a race against numbers.
But it's also, the park's not far from where we are. And so I said, why don't you come down here? He's like, by the time I'm down here, so the shoes, I forgot to charge the LED thing. Oh, fucking, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. I wasted half an hour.
I just use my bike now for good missions.
Like, I'm on, I'm off.
And especially having kids too.
It's like in nap times. I'm like, if I push hard, I can knock out 50 Ks on the trainer in a nap.
That's huge.
Yeah. If I push hard, yeah, about an hour 20, I can get it done.
That's great.
And but then you're stuffed. And then you're done for the day.
Oh, yeah, you're cooked after 50 Ks. But then, like, when people are like, when do you exercise? Like, I don't know. Sometimes at 6 in the morning, sometimes at 1:45 in the afternoon. Like,
yes.
Sometimes a little bit now and a little bit later. Like, that's what you have to do when you, like, it's great having the luxury to do it at home, but, you know, like a set gym time is a total fantasy for me. And I don't even have a real job. I don't know how the fuck people do it with real jobs.
You've just spent a bunch of weeks traveling around the wide brown land.
Yes.
I know that your work has taken you wonderfully across this Australia in many ways that many people would never, ever get to do.
That's true.
And I've spent a bit of time in parts of the country that people just don't go to. It's amazing. And people travel. The signs are in four different languages that aren't English because that many people from overseas come there.
Yeah, right.
And so many people from the city just never
like, what would be your favourite spots? Like, what are you thinking about when you think about that spot? What specific destination?
Oh, there's a lot of red dirt and a lot of Milky Way.
Yeah.
Like,
it's awesome, isn't it?
And look, honestly, in many ways, there's a lot of red dirt, there's a lot of Milky Way, and there is, the oldest continuous culture on the face of the planet is everywhere.
Yeah.
And I've lived a life of this weird kind of British colonial disconnection from this land that has been continuously occupied by this entire nations and nations of people.
Mm.
When you are out in Australia and when you are experiencing, I guess you're actually in parts of it, you're experiencing the frontiers where you've been. You're experiencing the frontiers of where, you know, modern society and this ancient culture are butting up against it. What do you feel when you're out there?
Yeah, immense smallness, like immense tininess. Like I think, like especially in the Kimberley and the, you know, like through Central Australia, the top end, you know, I know, and again, I'm the same, like, you know, what we're in that generation that's like trying to undo or at least recognize the patterns that we've learned and going, okay, you know, well-meaning people in our upbringing, but zero proper appreciation for Indigenous culture and, you know, aside from just the stuff we like very basically learned about, you know, the First Fleet, it, like you said, there was a huge disconnect. It was an interest. It was like, hey, this could be interesting. Isn't this interesting? The way that, you know, Aboriginal people have lived. Anyway, back to our way, rather than any deeper understanding or getting to walk and understand and learn from the stories of that are there if you can look and find. So being out in those places and especially, you know, walking with traditional owners and having a glimpse, albeit just for a day or two, just crazy smallness, I reckon, just seeing like, I love this country because it's my homeland as well, but I don't really, that's that feeling of like, I'm 39 and it's like a blip and you're thinking, yeah, that number is in your head, like 60,000 years of untouched, perfect harmony. There's just that thing of like going, man, I just feel like I'm understanding the surface. I just feel like you've walked on the surface of the land. and you have these little touch points to the real deeper connection, like the absolute understanding or the oneness of the land that comes when you are there with like First Nations people who have that understanding. So I think it's that normal mixture of emotions of just like, oh, I don't know anything. I love this place. Like this is of course my home country. And we all walk upon it and it's all our home country, but we don't understand it properly. And it lights up a huge hunger to want to know more and to just to want to be out there more and to understand it. But I think even what you said before, like just Red Earth and the Milky Way, like just being out there in that, I think is just good for the soul. I reckon that's the first step.
I found the very first time I was out there, like in the middle bit, I was shooting and I found myself whispering to my cameraman, like we were the only humans and besides the road, there was no structure, man-made structure to the horizon in every direction. And we were whispering to each other. Because we realize, oh, wow, we're the smallest thing here.
The bigness. And like the actual tourism ad is about how big Australia is. And, you know, there's probably a bit more of a spiritual meaning to it too, because it is absolutely the bigness of the country and the, I don't know, you just feel like a total guest. Like a fleeting, you feel like a fleeting, like as a human being, you feel like you're out there for a moment. And especially as a black guy, you feel like, I feel like I'm out here for a moment. And then getting to walk and learn from, you know, from traditional owners, you're like, okay, now I've got a touch point to something that's a lot bigger than a moment. But I just constantly felt that.
Well, I remember being out there once and we were walking with one of the custodians of the place we were at, and they were a white person, but they lived with the community. And this person was saying, oh, you know, I was at this waterfall or something the other day and some of the people from the community were telling me the story about an owl. And the way they were talking, she was like, I thought it was a creation story. I thought it was a Dreamtime story because the tense in the language and their broken English, what they were able to, you know, translate was, oh, I thought it was a Dreamtime story. It must have happened, you know, sometime, whatever. Anyway, so I just came back there the next day, an owl flew out of the cave. And it really hit home to me that the way we see time and the way in many ways these cultures see time are two completely different things.
Totally.
And it wasn't 50,000 years ago. No. It happened. That's all. And it happened there.
And ancestors.
Yeah.
And everything's walking as one.
It's now
as part of the land.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, I have a huge, you know, desire to understand more and to learn more and to spend more time learning a lot more and trying to understand a lot more about different Indigenous cultures in Australia. But that's certainly one of the things you just like, oh, we, you just begin to realize how many preconceived notions you bring and how much you just assume, bringing your own weird filters and backstories to it, which of course you have because you've grown up.
Yeah, that's how we grew up.
In different societies.
And the other thing that blows my mind is that the Dreamtime stories we get, they are the stories that you're allowed to hear before you've passed through any ceremony, as far as I understand it. So I asked, what did we hear? And this person says, we're getting basically the things you tell the toddlers.
Of course. And when you think about it, you're like, when was the last time you read a Dreamtime book? At primary school.
Yeah.
Like, it's the rainbow serpent.
Exactly. Yeah. But they're the things we get. But if you pass through ceremony and you become an elder, I think therefore I am, that wisdom is all there.
But we just don't
hear it. Yes. And so because this, I wonder, I guess it's not really a hot take, but I wonder if the only stories we heard were toddler level, did the people who first encountered were like, they're kids.
Yeah.
Or go, can't tell you that because you haven't gone through the pain ceremony. See this scar here? I earned this scar. And because of this scar, I now know this incredible wisdom that my culture keeps secret. I wonder about that. Sorry.
I agree. And but that's the thing. You just hit by like, oh man, there's so much we don't know.
So much.
Just a moment here before we get back to Hamish Blake. I just wanted to pop in for a moment, remind you that myself and James Matheson have got a new podcast out. It's called Idle Australians. We are out every Thursday exploring the bits you might have missed from Australian history and Australian culture. And this week we actually spoke with the people who are in charge of Play School, the people who hold the keys to this television show that has raised a nation and it's been on air for 55 years and it'll blow you away when you listen to how much effort and time and thought goes into each and every single episode. But it's also not just that, it's also a chance to catch up with my friend James. He's a little bit.
Yep, everything I'm wearing right now, I had nothing to do with the purchase of, and I'm wondering if this is happening in your life as well.
I would say any adult male in a long-term relationship would concur with you. It doesn't happen overnight. It's a very gradual process. The slow dissolution of your own sense of fashion, and for the better.
You can find Idle Australians wherever you find your podcasts. We'll get back to IDLE Australians. That's where you can find it. We'll get back to Hamish Blake in just a minute. You might hear an ad here. If you do, thanks for helping me keep the lights on. If you don't, there'll be more Hamish.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You are an incredibly high-profile person. You're a tall man. You've been in people's faces for 20 years or more. How do you look after yourself so you are there for your family?
Yeah, I think, I mean, in terms of balancing that, balancing a job that means you have a profile with your family, I think for me, it comes down to going, that is a part, like it's a side effect of what I've got to do for a living. Like it's a side effect of choosing fun, creative adventures as a way to make a living. But people knowing who you are is a necessary side effect of that and not unwelcome by any stretch of the imagination. Like I enjoy saying hi to people out and about and whatever, but you know that it's a part of a world, a game that you're playing. It's not who you are. Like my identity does not rely on being famous and doesn't rely on, you know, Hamish at home. If like the public version of Hamish Blake, who I guess are fairly similar because otherwise you're living a pretty tough life. But if that public side of things dried up, I'm quite fine with that. Because that's not who I am to my kids and my wife. He's a similar guy, but that's just sort of one of the hats I wear. So I think I've just always, like, I understand the world of having, you get to understand the world of having a profile and the way that that system works. And there are, of course, giant benefits to it. Like, you get to do some amazing things and having the career I've had, I'm overwhelmingly grateful versus any kind of cost of losing your anonymity. But you do understand it's a game. Like, that's just a game you have to learn how to play. Because I think I treat it as a game because I think if you believed it, if it became your identity, then you would absolutely lose yourself.
Do you think that's the same for people who have other jobs, people who work at a real estate agency or work at a bank?
I guess it is. I mean, I don't want to speak for people that work at a real estate agency, but it's probably easier to go like, hey, you know, my name's Sarah and, you know, I play footy on the weekend and I'm really interested in guitar and sailing, but for my job, I'm a real estate agent, but I could also be a nurse. It doesn't change all the shit I'm interested in. Like, it doesn't change who I am as Sarah. So I think when you have a job that you can check into and check out of, maybe that makes that line really clear and doesn't mean you can't love your job and be passionate about doing well at it. But I probably had to think about it a little bit, or I found I've had to think about it a bit because my job is being me. So it's a strange career to get into where you just like professionally are being yourself. I think it requires you to try and you got to have that conversation with yourself about going, okay, well, you are you for your job, but you're not relying on any like professional validation to be you, because if that goes away, it goes away. You're still going to be you. So I think you have to have, when your job is being you, you probably got to have that conversation with yourself. just to stay sane.
Man, I did not have that conversation with myself. And when it all went away, I was like, well, what happens now?
Yeah, right.
That's when I fell off the edge.
Okay. And that,
yeah, yeah. Anyway.
And what things brought you back?
I had to get sober.
Yeah, okay.
I had to get sober and have that conversation with myself.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. That was 10 years ago now. But when I first met you, I was absolutely, like in that, when I came to Matt and Joe, probably Troy would have been paneling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I would have absolutely been in it. I would have absolutely believed every single thing. You know, I'd like to think I was a special snowflake, but I'm not. I'm the guy that I've read about in every rock star biography that I ever read.
Yeah, right.
You know, I'm the same guy. It's the same story. And it was really kind of funny, actually. When I first got sober, I went to this, there's a fellowship of men and women that keep each other sober.
Yep.
And they have meetings sometimes. And I went to one of these meetings and that's not the meeting. If you go to that one, it's in Los Angeles. It's up on Sunset. And I went to this meeting. And I was like, holy shit, I've interviewed you. I've got all your CDs. I've camped out for tickets to your shows.
Yeah, right.
Right. Okay, here I am. And they all told the same story. I was like, oh, poo. Just the same.
Damn it.
It's like the same story. You know, it's the same story every time. I believe the bullshit.
But great. I mean, great that maybe in that stage you needed to see someone high profile.
I did.
The same problems? Because yeah. Interesting that you were like, I can't stay at the meeting with the regulars.
No.
I need the high-profile meeting.
Well, I think it's more about, because the meetings I was going to were all gay meetings, because the first person, the idea is like, if you want what we have and you'll go to any lengths to get it,
yeah.
We'll give you some steps to follow. And the guy that had what I wanted, he was an incredibly talented photographer, devastatingly handsome, life of the party and sober. I'm like, I need to know how you did that. I need to know how you stood there at this party with all these strangers and was just fine without drinking. And he said, cool, come to these meetings with me. And so the first meetings I ever went to were all in West Hollywood and I was the only straight guy in the room. And so I did that for months.
Yeah,
and then someone said, you maybe should go check out this other one up the road. I mean, the thing that was wild is that in that meeting, all the stories were the same again.
That's
like,
it.
It's like, all right, so even though you're from Kansas and you have a completely different upbringing, you're 10 years younger than me, you tell exactly the same story about what it's like to be in a room and not be drinking or to be in a room with people you don't know and have to drink. Ah, right. Okay, so I'm not special after all. But then someone said, you should go to this meeting.
Also, did you find that going to different meetings too, the extra perspective? Extra perspective but still the sameness.
Always hear something you need to hear. And that's the thing. Because if you have a resentment for something you're hearing, that's your ego going. Making noise, and that's the ego that you've got to battle. Anyway, we could go on. I'm grateful that you could be here, mate. Thank you so much taking the time to come and hang out.
Do you know, I'm loving this time in my life too because I'm not really doing too much, and so I just get to do things that I would like to do without needing to be pushing a TV show or whatever, and that's why I really want to do this.
Well, I'm really grateful.
I've wanted to for a long time. So,
oh, sweet. Oh, I'm so happy. I'm so happy. Well, I could do an entire 10-part series on the art and craft of keeping a radio career alive with you, but that's a whole other.
Great to be here for part one.
You know what? And it recorded.
I thought you were about to say it didn't. I was like, all right, well, that was a great rehearsal for part one.
Thanks, man.
Thanks, man.
And that was Hamish Blake. See, told you. You thought you were in love with the dude. You thought you're like, I couldn't admire this guy anymore. Uh-huh. He's incredible. He's an inspiration. He's a ray of light. He's the smell of fresh lavender wafting through the spring air. He's an incredible guy. He's an incredible guy. And I'm extraordinarily grateful that I got to spend that time with him. Thank you so much for listening to the show. If it has brought you anything, please tell a friend. Let somebody know. Shoot them a share link. Just text them or whatever. Just let someone know that you chat with. If you're in lockdown, good luck. We're all just trying to keep safe here, aren't we? We're all just trying to do what we can. If you're getting vaccinated, good luck. If you got vaccinated, good on you. We can only do what we can do and take care of the things that we can control. I'm back here on Thursday with Jimmy for Idle Australians. You can find us over there in the Idle Australians feed, and I'll be back here on Friday with you. Thanks again to Hamish. And thanks again, Sam, for lining it up. Big, big, big thanks to Andy Marr, my audio producer, and Rachel Barrett, my executive producer, for helping me make this show. If you need me, send us your email at gmail.com. Until I speak to you on Thursday with Jimmy, sleep well and dream of beautiful things.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.